ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, Giant Time is here. That's right, we're talking Friday the 13th, Part 7, The New Blood, on Kill by Kill. Well, greetings and salutations, Internet. It's your old pal Patrick Hamilton, and I'm coming to you from Camp Crystal Lake, or actually, it's Long Beach, and it's fucking hot as hell, so if you hear noise from the outside, it's because I cannot close the door. It's too hot at the beach, and this is the Kill by Kill podcast, where we are dedicated to celebrating the least discussed component of any horror film, the characters. And today we will be unpacking all the gory details of Friday the 13th Part 7 in the hopes that a partier's untimely end is just the beginning of the jokes we can make about them. And as always, the only person that I trust to help me clean up from all the mud that I leave right in front of the refrigerator, it's the one and only Gina Radcliffe. How you doing, Gina?
Oh, well, you know, I'm just chilling here in my Scrooge McDuck money chamber, you know, enjoying that sweet cash that's been rolling in ever since. So, yeah, I don't want to brag or anything, but, you know, we got ourselves a little mention in a column called Podmas on a little website called the AV Club. What have you been doing with your massive windfall, Patrick?
I've been spending my imaginary money on all sorts of things. You know, fame, fortunes, I got to brag to, my wife's family in Wisconsin when I was there for a family reunion. It doesn't sound so stupid when you're published. Take that, Dad! But we're very happy, that we were featured in Podmas. It's, dream come true, and for all those people who have joined us as a result of reading about us in Podmas, welcome to the podcast. We're so happy that you are here. But the good news is, Gina, we're not alone. That is right, we have ourselves a guest. This person is a Kill by Kill superstar. She is the co-host of Ladies Love Paul Rudd, the one and only Amy Pascal. How are you doing, Amy?
I'm doing very, very well, Patrick. Hello, Gina. I have to say, I mean, when we did the episode the last time, you guys were just a regular podcast. But now that you've been featured on the AV Club, like, I'm super excited for you. I did get all the fans that you sent so that when I'm in your presence, I have to fan you constantly. Mm-hmm. But they're beautiful. So I appreciate that. And I just, like, I know it's going to be a whole new different experience, and I cannot wait.
We're very highfalutin. We do mm-hmm. not want you to look at us in the eyes.
I know. I got that note. I do get that note.
I am just sitting here lighting cigars with $100 bills, and I don't even smoke cigars. That's how much I do not give a shit about this giant pile of money sitting next to me right now.
I would just like to remind everybody that it costs me $10 a month to do this podcast. $10. All right. And I'm not getting that $10 back, more than likely. So, Amy, we heard about your first experience with Friday the 13th in your first episode with us, mm-hmm. and that was us asking you to watch a Friday the 13th movie.
Exactly.
Now, I've heard that at the time, mm-hmm. you sort of insinuated that horror was not necessarily your thing.
Correct.
As the result of actually dipping a toe in, has that changed?
Well, I'm going to say that this time around, I had a completely different experience because I did not know when the deaths were going to occur. Kind of got excited because I've been listening to you guys and all these episodes so far, and I fully agreed with you that I do not understand how this group of people got together. That was completely baffling. But I kind of found a giddy glee as each new person was killed, because then I knew I was getting closer to whoever I had to see, and it was joyous. I do not know what that says about me, but I'd be like, oh, look how they died. Oh, look how they died. Ooh, three more people are going to die. And that was kind of really exciting. So I think I may think about watching a few more movies like that, especially if I can do it with such a joyful glee in my heart.
Oh, one of us. One of us. Mm-hmm. We all chant around the dining room table.
Of course, I'm sure a long time listeners of the Kill by Kill podcast will remember Amy's first appearance here, because it was notable for a couple reasons. One, she coined the term hashtag get bunked.
Yay!
She broke my brain. She broke it because she was under the impression at the time that the refrain of Mother Voorhees that Jason hears, the kill, 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 ma, 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 was a choo-choo train. Mm-hmm. She thought it was a choo-choo train, and he was obsessed with choo-choo trains.
Choo,
again, it doesn't really happen that slowly, Amy. I think that's the big thing that I can't get past.
It does, though. I swear it did. It did. It did.
Well, I don't doubt your experience, because only you can experience it. But I hear that you might have made a new auditory discovery.
Yes. So I went into this expecting to hear the kill, 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 and, you know, as you were doing that. And I was listening very closely, because I also want to say I feel a little vindicated, because you guys were like, no, there's no train business going on in these movies. And then Patrick, the Kill by Kill Twitter account, I believe, posted a GIF where a train is running into a woman. Like a toy train is running into like some woman, dead woman's head. And I felt a little vindicated that there are trains in there. But in this one, as I was waiting to either hear choo 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 or kill kill kill, for the most part, it sounds like he's shushing people. It sounded like shh 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 shh. And I was like, how is this supposed to be scary? Like, when he would get really close to people, like I remember particularly in the moment where he was killing Dr. Cruz and Tina's mom, you distinctly hear him say kill kill kill. But honestly, the majority of the time it sounds like he's shushing people. And I was like, okay, so does his kill 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 change every time? Because, like, you know, there's choo choo trains and there's kill kill kill, and now there's shush shush shush.
Yeah, I think he's trying to quiet people. I think he's trying to quiet the fucking orchestra that's freaking out every half second in this movie.
There's a lot of strange musical stings in this sequence alone.
Yes. There's just oddities throughout. I mean, Amy and I were texting briefly earlier. She started watching, and she was, talking about the same thing we had discussed about the opening credits. It's just insane.
Like, it's the most ridiculous thing. It's like 2 minutes of just text with little bong or like impact noises.
Yeah. It sounds like a robot farting. And I should know, I used to professionally run a robot.
Did you really?
Terrible. Yeah. Yes. For, we're talking about 10 minutes of this movie. Folks, we got to stretch this shit out. Once upon a time, when I returned from a gig in Japan, I had no job. Mm-hmm. And I had no job for a very long time until a former colleague said, this group needs help with this robot show that Honda's doing. And they have that Osmo robot, and they were going to tour it through museums all throughout the United States.
Wow.
And so I went down there, and with the idea that all I would do would be like take the robot out of box, push a button, robot does show, and I just sit back collecting money.
Of course.
And it turns out that this robot is upset if there is a slight crack in the floor or if someone expels a whistle too loud. It just falls over to the ground. It climbed stairs, but very delicately. And if it falls over on you, it hurts. So I was a robot wrangler once upon a time. And then I met my now wife, then girlfriend. I'm like, how do I get out of this gig? And then the robot fell on top of me. And I'm like, oh, that's my excuse. I'm out. I toured Jersey City, and I got that robot on the Today Show, and I was like, fuck this noise, and I left.
I think you went out pretty big. Jersey City and the Today Show is pretty good way to go.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and bodily harm.
That's the way you need to go out.
Yeah.
Jersey City and the Today Show.
Exactly.
That fucking weatherman wouldn't get out of my way. It's like this, the robot is standing next to him and waving. And everyone off stage is like, move, move. You see the tape on the floor? That's where he walks. Move. And he's like, is this all this robot does? It does if you stand in its way, motherfucker. He doesn't have free will. There's not a joystick where I'm moving it around after the fact. It's not deadly fucking friend.
Ugh. He should have, right. He should have just killed him at that point.
If I had a basketball, yes. That would have happened. Spoiler alert for Deadly Friend, which I do not believe is available anywhere. We are back into the middle of Friday the 13th, Part 7, which has zero robots in it that I'm aware of. Let's do a quick body count. Who's still left alive at this point in the motion picture? We're going to start with Tina, who is a young woman still dealing with the guilt of killing her father by flirting with bad boys and throwing TVs around a room with her mind. Then we have Nick. And he's a perma-confused beau whose haircut appears to get more and more square as the movie goes on. We have Tina's mom, Mrs. Shepherd, whose pants are just as up and tight as she is. Dr. Bad News Cruz, a character affected with more tics than an Alabama basset hound. And then we open our episode on Melissa. Oh, Melissa. Who, when we last left her, had concocted a plan to win over Nick by letting Eddie maul her neck and dry hump her shin. And my question to the both of you is,
yeah,
has anyone dry humped you this badly in life? You don't have to answer. Yes. My response to you is, I've never tried to get off on someone's shin like I'm the beagle that my parents
It's fine that you ask that question because I will pose yes. a somewhat similar question to you in a few moments. I will say that I can mm-hmm. definitely believe that someone like Eddie would be clumsily rubbing himself against the nearest female leg that will not immediately draw away from him in horror.
Mm-hmm.
It is not the way to turn anyone on, and what he's wearing also doesn't help, which he looks like a kid who wandered down a Christmas morning to find that Santa hadn't left him anything.
he got that match in undershirt and tighty whities. That's always a good look for a 22-year-old man.
Oh my god, it's not a good look for anybody. The costumer has done no one in this movie any favors, but Eddie really gets it bad. I can't say that he deserves better, but that's not a good look. That ain't turning anybody on. Now, you match that with Melissa's white button down, and there's a lot of white on white on white going on.
Yeah.
That is true.
Oh, my goodness.
Her haircut is... I don't know what is going on. Is that supposed to be appealing? Because
yes.
And I'm speaking as a person who once found Bess Armstrong super, super sexy. That is a very patrician haircut, and it just doesn't read hot to me.
May I make a comment on that?
Of course.
Did that somehow involve High Road to China?
No, it was before High Road to China, at least what I saw. I first saw her on television in some miniseries called, like, Silk or something or other. And then she appeared in Jaws 3D, which we covered briefly in our 3D movies of the 80s episode. And she had a weird affectation in that movie where every time she would kiss her boyfriend in it, she would go, hi, honey, every time.
Oh, that's
Dennis Quaid. Every time she kissed Dennis Quaid, she's like, hi, honey.
That is weird.
Yeah.
That's family rule. High Road to China was one of those movies that was on HBO a lot, so therefore I watched it a ton. It's probably terrible. I haven't gone back to watch it, but I thought Bess Armstrong was so awesome and, like, just so stylish and such a awesome badass. And then when she showed up as a mom in My So-Called Life, I was really, really excited.
Yeah.
I just remember her being more the kind of, you know, concerned girlfriend in many 80s movies. Like, I believed there was a movie with Tom Hanks and that she played a concerned girlfriend, and she does that sort of, you know, kind of dismayed, very practical woman thing very well.
You should see High Road to China.
Wasn't High Road to China just basically like making it up to Tom Selleck for turning down Raiders of the Lost Ark or not getting it or something like that?
Well, I think it was not getting it. I think he was supposed to get it. I think he was about to walk out, and they wouldn't let him at Magnum PI, wouldn't let him out of his contract.
Yes.
Just like Remington Steele wouldn't let Pierce Brosnan out of his contract to go be Bond.
At least in both those circumstances, it was for the right reasons. Neither of those people should have been James Bond or Indiana Jones at that point in their life. It was fine.
I agree.
We weren't denied anything. As High Road to China, I think, actually proves, is that Tom Selleck has a level of rakish charm, but there's also, you just can feel the conservatism coming off of him a little bit.
Yeah.
I'm really glad that we're trying to reach the youth with this podcast. We really have our finger on the millennial pulse with these up to date, just cutting fucking edge references.
Yeah, that sound you hear is a million fidget spinners just going like, "Why did I listen to the AV Club and listen to this fucking podcast?"
Well, Gina, you're there burning all of your, like, you know, $100 cigarettes that are wrapped in $100 and stuffed with $100 and burning them with $100. So you shouldn't care.
I got this avocado toast and I'm just going to savor it.
There you go.
Hey, that's a house payment. Anyways, this thing between Eddie and Melissa really doesn't work out. She finally tells him, "Oh, you're not, this is terrible. Get off of me, please." And luckily for all of us, he actually listens to her.
Mm-hmm.
She does this by telling him that he doesn't really turn her on and, quote, "You just didn't come through." I assume she's talking about his underwear.
Yeah, I'm not sure what she meant. Like, come through what?
But the little hole in his underwear.
Oh, God.
I'm going to give her a little bit more credit and think that he just, you know... It's one thing, like, if you are not totally attracted to somebody, but if he's had a little bit of game, then, you know, like, you know, or maybe he just meant go down on her. I think that's where it is. Like, if he had just gone straight down on her, then she would have hung around for a little bit longer.
Yeah, I don't...
Humped her foot rather than her shin?
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't think that Eddie could find the clitoris on a map with a flashlight.
Oh, I don't disagree with you, but I'm just saying, if you know, her comment was... "You just didn't come through," then I think that's the implication of, like, you did not get me off in any way, shape, or form, so I am so not entertaining you whatsoever.
Now here's a question that I wanted to pose to you, Patrick. When he leaves the room, he says he's going to shower, and I've got a date with a soap on a rope.
Yes.
Now, I am not an expert on male masturbation. Mm-hmm. I spent a good 45 seconds or so trying to imagine how one would pleasure oneself with a soap on a rope, and I just, it sounded like, you know, spark plugs just going off in my head but not firing. It just was not, nothing was coming to mind, and I feel like that this was like either the screenwriter's, you know, attempt at saying something witty or Eddie's attempt at saying something witty, and I'm not sure, because it doesn't work and it's just kind of weird and awkward, and you know, Eddie's last few minutes on this planet are, you know, just him being being, you know, gross and entitled.
Yeah, I thought about it long and hard, and the only thing I could really come up with is that he was going to bind his penis like a foot. And then he was into some sort of pressure and release thing. I don't know. They're hipsters.
And he didn't shower anyway, because when we next see him, he's just sitting in the living room sulking, still in his underpants.
If that was an insult to her, it doesn't fly. If it was a witticism from him, it doesn't fly. As a writer, I don't know that I believe in his instrument right now. In fact, when he walks away, before he makes his soap on a rope comment, he says, "You know, I can handle rejection because I've been rejected by some of the finest sci-fi magazines in the continent of the United States." Which means that Alaska and Hawaii are still on the board, everybody.
gonna lie, I really kind of like that line. I thought it was like this stupid perfect thing that, you know, they're really trying to hit home the stupid dorkiness of him, and I kind of appreciated it. Like, because I think it just even solidified what a hopeless soul he was, and was so utterly oblivious, and was obviously never, ever going to have sex in his life.
No, and that does not happen. No. Unless he had sex before he arrived at this cabin, which, based on his behavior that we saw on camera, was not a possibility.
No.
So let's then cut to outside, where Jason Voorhees spends the majority of this sequence that we're talking about just wandering from place to place. It is the most aimless performance. We've had really good Jasons and some not so great Jasons, but for the way people talk about this Jason, you would think that this was a blockbuster performance. And I find it, at least in this part of part 7, I think it improves during the third act, but this part, he just kind of wanders here and there, and then he yanks out the electricity to the party cabin. We get to hear the Jason train pulling into the station right before he does it. And this is only the second time I can remember pulling the maneuver of, I gotta cut the power. He does it in part 3, but it's not really a regular Jason go-to maneuver.
I mean, I feel like he has done it more often, but maybe you're right, he hasn't. There's, like I said, he seems kind of unsure of himself in a lot of these scenes. It's like it's still all coming back to him.
He's waterlogged, perhaps. Like, he needs to just knock out the loose liquid up in his what used to be his brain case.
I feel like he spends a lot more time just hiding, which is something he didn't do much of before. I mean, he would just like walk right up to people and, you know, splat or slash or whatever. But no, he's lurking in corners and kind of sneaking up behind people. And that's not the Jason we know and love.
Yeah, part 2 Jason, he does a lot of stalk and slash, which was the, you know, flavor at the time. We get a lot of shots of his killer POV, and of course the one POV that we always remember and it should be enshrined on his tombstone, and that is the penis POV of him looking at the dog muffin.
I will say that the new and unimproved, but, you know, kind of sneaky, but yet kind of tentative Jason, that works to one good effect, and it is the scene where, is it David? David, is that the pothead? Okay. David is going downstairs to get some food, and lightning flashes, and for like a split second, you can see Jason standing in the corner. I think that is probably the only genuinely scary moment in the whole movie. Like, I'm pretty sure I didn't remember seeing that before. And I'm like, oh, he's just standing right there. That's kind of cool.
So this Jason, right, he's been underwater and been like, you know, just basically locked down until Tina's superpowers like makes him alive again or whatever the heck it is. So I think this is Jason in rehab. I think he's like kind of going through PT, and, you know, like if you've been in a coma for a really long time, you have to learn how to walk again, guys.
True.
You have to learn how to like feed yourself again. You have to learn how to dress yourself again. And I think that, you know, you are a little fuzzy headed. I mean, it hasn't been that long since he's just suddenly been brought back to whatever Jason life it is. And I think that's like he's still feeling his body out because he doesn't really know how it works. And I think it even goes to like why he keeps cutting the power, because he needs a handicap. Like, this is his handicapping his game, like a golfer handicaps their game. Like, he's like, you know what? I need a little bit. Like, I am usually a ninja. Okay. I am usually a motherfucking ninja that can like fly all out, like, and be in all the different rooms at all the times, but he really can't do that. He's not much of a ninja, like, at least in this sequence. I think, like, Gina, your whole fuck style thing is like, I think he's slowly kind of getting back into that, but I think that this is a Jason that has been, he's been through some stuff, some physical stuff, and he's not fully at 100%, and he's just kind of like doing his darndest to get back to that.
It's true that he does read David's fuck style in that, in the afterglow of having sex, David wants baloney. Which leads me to believe that David eats a lot of bologna, which makes me wonder how David ever has sex at all. This sequence here with Robin and David leaves a lot of spark to be desired. At one point, they're just making out with one another because I can't believe any sort of part is inserted into the other. And he kind of awkwardly holds her back, like how my 3-year-old played with Play-Doh for the first time. It's just like a lot of open-palmed touching.
Yeah, I get the impression that these actors might have met the day they had to do this scene together.
David is quite a charismatic character. At one point, he does a pratfall. You know, one of those signature Peter Sellers like Pink Panther pratfalls, where he falls off the bed and blames the fact that it's dark. Now, he was sitting on the bed. Darkness generally doesn't displace your ass for the most part. I think the only reason that this really occurs is that he falls and then Robin is so delighted by David's wackiness that she sits straight up so we can get that court-mandated nudity that we were lacking in part 6. We just had to get it back, and she's going to deliver it, damn it.
Well, I'm going to say I appreciate the fact that she was delivering it, because all of David's nudity was, he was so skinny, like you can see his bones at some point, and it was really unsettling to me. And I just was like desperate for anybody who looked like a normal person. And so then when we get Robin's like super cute perky breasts, I was like all in, like just keep the camera on her, because yeah, David was just so not interesting and very, very distracting in that sort of a way.
Yeah, and also, like, who was the guy who got his head crushed in the last episode? I've already forgotten a lot of these characters' names.
Ben.
Okay, he apparently went to the Ben School of Seduction, in which he left his underwear on while they were having sex, because I was bracing myself. I was bracing myself for unremarkable butt shot, and I'm like, oh, he at some point put his underwear back on.
Yes.
And it that's always cracks me up because of the outrageous, unrealistic, you know, means that a movie will go to avoid showing male nudity.
Yeah, where are them like, buns? Don't we get to see what that booty do? It's like, this is the 80s, this is the height of men's buns, and we almost never see any buns in a Friday the 13th movie.
No, it's very limited to naked chicks, but I mean, really, that's not changed much now. I mean, again, you have like the man getting out of bed in his own apartment where the only other person is in there is the woman he just made love with, and he's wrapping a sheet around himself. I mean, I you know, you have a child, Patrick, so mm-hmm. I mean, apparently you're not just running through the house delightfully naked for all to see, but generally speaking, if you're alone in the house with only the other person you've had sex with, you're just gonna be, I mean, anyway, it would seem to me that you would be just, you know, out there in all your glory. But in every movie, it's, nope, got to do the complicated toga wrap to go to the bathroom.
Well, it's very cold, and my nether regions get tingly when they're not encased in a red bikini brief.
I'm waiting for the pictures.
So, yeah, David goes to find food. He finds mud all over the kitchen floor.
Is it mud? I thought it was blood.
But who would it be? Whose blood would it be?
Well, yeah, because I actually was wondering that. I was like, okay, he's not concerned that there is some sort of fluid all over the floor.
Because the last two people killed were Ben and Kate, and Ben got his head crushed. And I'll grant you that there's probably some corpse juice happening there. But Kate's death was relatively bloodless, at least that we could see. He does squish every time he walks. I mean,
that's true.
He's like SpongeBob SquarePants all up in this whole place. It's just constantly quack, 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 quack.
Can I say what my favorite part about David's death is?
Sure.
So Jason comes up behind him. David turns around and says, "Maddie?" Now, he is confusing a 6'4"-ish rotting corpse for a short, slightly chubby 19-year-old girl. I just feel like that's like an extra middle finger the movie gives to poor Maddie. Is that this you know, this hideous creature standing behind him is the girl who has been, you know, looking at him with big cow eyes up, you know, for most of the movie.
Well, what you don't understand is that in that light was just lightning flashes. The holes in his hockey mask do sort of give that Sally Jesse Raphael like glasses look.
And this brings me back, because the same thing happens later with Eddie, in which he hears someone behind him and says, oh, did you change your mind? Assuming that it is Melissa, why is nobody smelling this thing coming?
There's only two solutions to this, Gina. One is that everyone can't smell. Or two, Melissa smells like Jason.
Or a third option is that the house just reeks of weed.
Yeah, there you go. True.
I cannot smell weed once I've smoked it. I can smell weed when someone else is smoking it, or in the air, or before it gets to me. And then once I imbibe, goodbye. I don't smell it anymore. So maybe that's part of it. Everyone's nose is just shot out from my unable to smell pot disease.
Would you ever conceive of confusing Becky for a 6'4" rotting corpse?
No. Not even if Jason was pantsless. Because more often than not, Becky does not wear pants in the house. And we have many windows in our house. It's a house with tons of windows. It doesn't matter. She doesn't like pants. And you know what? I don't like pants on her, so it all works out for all of us. Yeah, I like that part. And so Jason just knifes him in the gut. This is sad. This whole section is sad.
Yeah, it's
when people don't like part 7, I'm kind of like, oh, it's fun, it's goofy. But I think this part is what they're talking about, where it just kind of sits there and does the least amount of work.
It is incredibly low quality.
it's like, it's so uneventful. It's almost as if like they knew what they were going to do for the other death, and knew that they were going to have I can't really say it's special effects, but it's something. And you know, like later on with their fights and whatnot, so like maybe they just forgot that they had all these extra people, like as they were filming, and like, oh damn it, shit, yeah, we need to like kill 3 more people. Like, what's the cheapest possible way that we can do it? And this was it. Like, it's so uneventful. Like, it's just kind of boring.
It's really boring, and all 3 of these deaths are subpar to much better deaths, not only in this movie, but every other movie preceding it is.
Mm-hmm.
It is like, we haven't had a dull ass stomach knifing, I think, since part 2. And that has a lot more atmosphere going on to it. This is just, oh, it like you said, it feels like they forgot. And they're like, oh, we got a cram. What can we do? Just knife him in the gut. Works for me. Roll the cameras. But David's not here. Get him out of the trailer. Let's knife him in the gut. Come on.
Yeah, I found myself more than I usually do already paying attention to stuff in the background. And I noticed, particularly with the scene with Eddie, that is, you know, the movie provides yet more evidence of what thoughtless assholes these characters are. Because they have apparently gone to bed, or Bone Town, depending on the character, without putting any of the food away. Including a whole intact birthday cake, which is just sitting out on the coffee table.
Well, I guess because it's so cold, it's like an icebox in there anyway. So I guess they figure it's fine. I'm not sure. This is Friday the 13th disease. People have forgotten to do things that they would normally do. In part 5, it's leave an entire restaurant's worth of food out. Here, it's just everything you brought to the party. Half full cans of slice and a birthday cake. It's gross. People are gross here.
I think maybe they're just assuming that all kids are going to, like, run off and fuck. So why would they think about food?
Yeah.
Well David thought about food, and look what happened.
There you go. See, all Gino, right. So then here's the go. You prove your point. You've just proven your point. Like, if he had just not thought about food and left it home or left it alone, he would be fine and he'd be alive right now. Right now.
Right now, he would still be having awkward patty cake sex with Robin as we speak. Yeah, that sequence with Eddie in particular, there's a little editing trick where they try to reestablish the fact that Jason's in the house. And I think they just took a random shot of Jason walking across the windows, and he looks less like a mutant stalking its prey and more like a guy who's gotten really chafed in his bikini area and has to walk in wide shuffles.
Yeah, I'm also, this is another one of those things that Friday the 13th is famous for, with the physics of the house that changes size at will. Where, you know, it is small enough that, you know, people are sharing rooms with each other, and yet large enough that someone sitting in the living room cannot hear someone in the kitchen being brutally murdered. Yes. Yeah, I think the most egregious example of that was probably part 4, in which Jason was just literally walking up and down the stairs, just randomly killing people, and nobody else in the house heard him.
Well, and parts of that, it's almost like he leapt up flights of stairs from the outside. There's that one point, and we get to see a version of the defenestration death here, which is so poor in comparison to the part 4 version that it's practical heresy to bring it up. But yeah, the house is big enough that everyone gets a giant bedroom, and yet, like, because David was having sex in Robin's room, and then Robin goes to David's room later on, and David's room is like a master fucking bedroom. That is ridiculous. Yeah.
And it looks like a tornado went through it, and they've been there, what, a day?
There's so much paraphernalia. Folks, you don't need this much.
Can we talk a minute about the joint laying out on the table? It looks it's about as long as a ballpoint pen. It honestly looks like something Cheech and Chong would smoke. It is absurd.
Cheech and Chong would be like, slow your roll. It's giant. It's comical. It looks like a comedy cigar that would blow up in somebody's face that you would order out of the back of a comic book. It's fucking ridiculous. Kill, 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 kill. Break, break, break.
Good afternoon, Max Funsters. Hope you had a fabulous day here at Max Fun High, home of the Fighting Beats by Dre. Just a few announcements before we dismiss for the day. First off, thank you to everyone who came to Mr. Kalen's going away party at the Flophouse. We were sad to see him transfer to Max Fun Prep in Los Angeles, but we wish him all the best. Next, the Rose Buddies, who I can only assume are a gardening club, are watching classic reality television at Hinterlands, the Senior Lounge, every Monday at 8 p.m., I don't know what this has to do with gardening, but they seem like a good bunch, so join them. And finally, remember that the Super Senior Prom is coming up on Saturday, September 23rd at the Footlight in Queens, New York, and it's not too late to buy your tickets. Only $20 each. The proceeds go to charity. The theme is Time Ain't Nothing But a Number. All right. And you are encouraged to wear fancy attire from any time period. For more information, go to bit.ly/mfprom, that's bit.ly/mfprom, and join us for dancing, drinking, and raffle prizes. Go Beats!
This announcement was brought to you by the Max Fun Prom Committee, an arm of the unofficial NYC Max Fun fan group. This prom is a real thing. Please come!
Kill, 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 break, 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 break. Greetings and salutations, killers. We're taking a quick break in the action to let you know that if you rate and review us on iTunes, we will talk about it here on the air because you deserve it. You went out of your way. Well, our friend Kira Napoleon left us a lovely review on iTunes saying that there are so many Friday the 13th movies and so many people die in each one that it's really, they start to blend together. This podcast lovingly mocks every slash and hack character and really gets into how baffling most of these movies are. It's hilarious and very bingeable. Thank you ever so much, Kira. If you rate and review us on iTunes, we will talk about it here on the air. Hey, tell us what's your favorite Friday the 13th kill is, and we'll talk about that too. Anyways, let's get back to the action. The body count continues right now. Kill, 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 kill. Break, 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 break. All right, so let's rewind here a little bit, because there are some major plot points that we're missing. They're all Tina and Nick related. They're still wandering in the middle of the woods. They happen to find Michael's body. He's still awkwardly cradled in the arms of a tree. He's still blinking like a crazy person, which is strange for a dead body, but lots of blinking out of him. No one behind the camera said, let's take another one on that close up. Nope. Still blinking. And Tina reacts with both the thrill that she's proven right, and then the sudden realization, oh no, this is a human being and Nick is connected to him. And so she goes, hey, I know that you're mourning your deadbeat DWI loving cousin, but we gotta beat feet. Let's get out of here. They make it all the way back to Casa Shepherd, and they go into Daddy Shepherd's train loving office.
Oh, interesting.
Oh, did you not see that choo-choo hat that he's wearing in the framed photograph?
I think I missed it. I think I might have zoned out during parts of this.
Okay. Well, there's three major things that they find in here. One is that the spike that Dr. Bad News Cruz hid was actually just sitting out on this fucking desk. Actually, Mrs. Shepherd brought it out of a drawer, but whatever. Again, Tina is right. Two is that there is a possibly loaded semi-automatic pistol just sitting in a drawer. And Tina hands it to Nick like it's a used diaper. Which I get. I'm not big around firearms either. But he turns it kind of upside down like he's checking to see what sex a puppy is. And that is like, okay, I'm satisfied with this. And the third is what is basically Roy's evidence wallet from part 5, only in diary form. Whose book is this filled with Jason Voorhees articles?
This is where maybe the third or fourth time I have questioned Dr. Cruz's motives in this.
Yes.
Because now we're supposed to assume that he has brought Tina and her mother to this place where he knows, you know, fairly recently there has been a supernatural, insanely powerful serial killer for ...
Yeah, how does this turn into money? How do you monetize this?
did he know that she would somehow be able to bring Jason back? Because he has changed motives at least three times in this movie, and we still have a half hour to go.
Unless he's got a secret Busta Rhymes-like web show happening, where it's a pay-per-view between Tina, the telekinetic powerhouse, and Jason fucking Voorhees, where do you take this from here and go, voila, I'm famous town. I'm Dr. Oz now. Buy my vitamin supplements. How does this work in his favor? Is it his diary or is it Daddy Shepherd's diary? I don't know. There's so many questions.
I'm pretty sure it's supposed to be Dr. Cruz, but again, it's not clear, nor is it ever made clear what this is supposed to mean, what the audience... I mean, obviously he's telegraphed immediately that this is a bad guy who will get his comeuppance to the audience's satisfaction, which he does, more or less. But he is a bad guy whose motives are so unclear that it is hard to pass judgment on him. He's more squirrely than evil.
He's incompetent in his bad guyery. It's really, really odd. There's actually a fourth thing that happens in this room that's super, super important. And I want you guys to buckle up. Nick discovers Tina's powers, and he does it when she looks at these news articles and begins to make the room quake in what can only be described as a telekinetic orgasm. telekinetic organism.
Oh, I like telekinetic organism.
Yeah.
Like that. I like that. Yeah, telekinorganism, but I like telekinetic organism. There's something about adding that extra K in there.
Yeah.
Like it's the extra K for power.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Completely unnecessary, but it works.
It's not in either word, and yet I added it in.
I like it. It's a little Cronenbergian to me. It sounds like a kind of, you know, X-rated version of Scanners.
Telekinetic organism. I love this word so much that I'm just going to start randomly saying it at people.
Listen, and if your telekinetic organism lasts longer than 4 hours, see a doctor.
Well, I have to say, I remember the scene very distinctly. I like, because again, I was fading in and out, but I was watching this going, oh, okay, now I know that I have not been watching this entire movie very, very closely, but is her telekinetic experience, I don't remember her looking like she was having an orgasm every single time.
But this is a really big one.
It is a huge one. I mean, this is, wow.
I mean, I'm surprised that the camera doesn't cut to an older lady in the corner and pointing to her and says, I'll have what she's having.
Yeah, I definitely I definitely tabbed over to something else. And then I was like, what in the hell is happening in this scene? Oh, the room is literally shaking. Okay, I see.
And she's shaking and her body's shaking and it's a telekinetic organism. Like, yeah. There is no other explanation for this scene. It is not just her moving things with her brain or having whatever kind of crazy experience. Like, that was pure sexual sort of thing. Like, so sexual that I, you know, along with the whole fuck cell thing, like, how did Jason just not come to her immediately at that point? Because... wow.
Yeah, I think this is the audience is supposed to take away from this is now she's a woman.
Yes! Yes!
We've witnessed it. And Nick was there. He helped unlock this, that, and old news articles.
I think, you know, maybe it's kind of a thing where, you know, we've seen Eddie, who obviously has no idea what to do with a woman. Mm-hmm. And then we've got Tina, who just gets the job done on her own. Like, if we had Tina and what's the blonde one's name?
Melissa.
Not Maddie. Melissa. Like, if we had those two together, oh my God. Like, Melissa would definitely not have kicked Tina out of the room, even though Melissa's been a total bitch this whole time. But if, like, she could telekinetic an orgasm, like, both herself and other people in the room, like, this would be a whole different movie, and I would watch it multiple times.
Oh, yeah. If we had a whole Chevy Chase Modern Problems telekinorganism sequence, have you guys ever seen Modern Problems? It's not good, but it does have its own telekinorganism.
I feel like the plot of Modern Problems could be described as cocaine. Am I right?
Yeah.
Once again, finger on the pulse of 2017.
Oh my God, so many millennials are not going to Chili's and listening to this right now.
Hey, we threw sex in there, Gina. We threw sex in there.
That's true. That'll keep them listening.
That's right. Let's don't cash any checks.
Maybe we'll tell more. Maybe in our next episode, we'll tell more stories of awkwardly losing virginity, because that's always the thing to go to.
So, Melissa sneaks out of the party cabin, and we practically hear the Pink Panther theme as she leaves. Eddie opens up Michael's gifts. What the fuck?
Oh,
all these
yeah.
people are terrible. They're terrible themselves, and they're terrible to each other. And I would just never think if someone didn't show up to a birthday party, I'm like, you know what? I'm going to open up his gifts because I didn't get laid tonight. Fuck you.
He's terrible.
It looks like everybody bought his gifts from Spencer's Gifts.
I hope
so. Oh, yeah.
I hope every single one of those is a gag gift. I hope they're all as hilarious as the one, which is a personal penis enlarger, which turns out to be a small magnifying glass. That is the height of humor. Thank you, Friday the 13th.
Somewhere in one of those packages is a pair of novelty underwear. It says Home of the Whopper on them.
Fingers crossed. But we never find out because Jason, again, just saunters into this room like he's actually looking for the craft service table. Eddie mistakes the scent of rotting, waterlogged flesh for the girl he awkwardly dry humped earlier. To his surprise, it turns out to be Jason Voorhees, and I guess he gets, like, neck chopped, kind of?
He slashes his throat.
Well, I have to say, this death and possibly the next death, like, at least with David, and again, because I was, like, watching every death with Giddy Glee, so I had the description that it was David the stoner who gets knifed, so I was waiting for that. Mm-hmm. I kind of had to rewind because I completely missed this. Like, because I heard him talk about the penis enlarge or whatever, and I think I just kind of rolled my eyes and tuned out. And then they were off to doing something else, so I kept waiting for Eddie to be killed. And everyone just kept going around asking for David. Yeah. So, or was it Michael? I don't even know who they were calling for. So I thought it was going to be him. But yeah, that's how uneventful it was. It was just, eh. And yeah, it was put under a table or something.
Yeah, the tension and release going on here is sort of misfiring in this portion of the movie. Let's give everyone a real quick example of how poorly this section of the movie is directed. After Eddie is dispatched, Jason sort of ambles, let's say, upstairs. We then go to Robin's room, where she exposes herself again, puts on a shirt. And then we get, and I counted, a 15-second shot of a doorknob. and the music is kind of like, what's going to happen with this doorknob? And my guess is someone's going to use it to open a fucking door. Why am I looking at a doorknob for 15 fucking seconds.
I think that they might have been trying to set the audience up to think that a scene similar to in Halloween after Bob is killed, but then Michael Myers shows up with the, which is kind of ridiculous in retrospect, scene. He's got the Charlie Brown Halloween sheet over his head.
With the glasses on top of the sheet. This is a killer who drove away earlier, who never touched a car before, but he doesn't know how glasses and a ghost costume work.
Because the setup is very similar. They're both stoned out of their minds. He goes to get you, and I think in Halloween he went to go get more beer, and this one he went to go get food. He gets killed, she's in bed, boobs, out for everyone to see. But no, it's gotcha audience, it's Robin coming out from the other side of the door.
And she's gonna just wander around. Why is everyone else's door locked from the inside? Would you trust
any of these people?
No. I would protect myself. But then again, none of these people are in the house. They've been killed outside. So Jason went up there, locked the doors from the inside in order, in his sort of I know your fuck style way, to lead her specifically to one room where there's a lot of loose joints.
And a cat. That was not there before.
It's just been sitting in that closet this entire time.
I have a note in all caps. Where did that cat come from? With three question marks afterwards.
She makes the comment like, "Who are you?" Like, David doesn't have a cat, and I was really thrown by that. I was like, wait, why are you even putting this in here? You know, it's like that alone made it even more ridiculous. I was like, well, then where did the cat come from? Like, is the cat like luring people in for Jason? Like, is he a sidekick? Is he a therapy animal? Going back to my rehab thing. Like, did Jason, when he came out of the lake, he found this cat, this stray cat, the two of them bonded. They're going to go on adventures together. And so the cat is like, finding ladies or people to get them to calm down, relax, that Jason can just up
or,
and kill
or here's
them.
Here's another topical reference. Perhaps he's like the cat in Cat's Eye, a harbinger of terrible things to come.
That is true. That is a possibility. I do like and I had forgotten this until just now, that she says, oh, David doesn't have a cat. As if part of their conversation after the first time they had sex was, do you have a cat? Did you bring him with you? Oh, you didn't? Well, I found a cat upstairs.
So. Yeah, because this was this isn't David's home, right?
No, of course not.
Okay, that's what I thought.
This is Russell's uncle's cabin.
Exactly. Exactly. So why would it even matter if David had a cat or not? Why would David have brought his cat to a cabin? Maybe if it was a dog, okay. But people don't really bring their cats up to a cabin.
Not for a birthday party.
You don't pack up your cat with your rolling papers and all for a trip to the Jersey woods.
Yeah, it's fucking ridiculous. In fact, that might be the most ridiculous goddamn thing in this entire movie. But wait, there's more. Because Robin then tries to lure this cat back for, what, 2 minutes? It's interminable. In the meantime, the soundtrack is practically doing loop-de-loops or going off in a rocket car across the Grand Canyon. It's just so over the top. And you're like, all right, I get it. I'm supposed to be spookumified, but it's not happening. And finally, she reaches down and touches a wet spot. And it's not where they had just had sex. It turns out to be blood. And then we reveal the worst representation of a decapitated head I've seen outside of the 99-cent store to date.
This thing looks like it was made out of Sculpey.
Yes.
I mean, and it's not just that it was so poorly done, but they also made the wise decision to not let the camera linger on it too long. I assume that was David?
I paused it. Luckily, I have the power of Blu-ray. And yes. So I get to see it in all its glory. First of all, it's sweating. It's literally sweating. So whatever they made it out of, the lights have made it seep moisture out of it.
They sculpted out of the leftover bologna from the
it's entirely possible. It's made out of the Play-Doh that he was playing with previously on Robin's back. The eyes have gone a pale blue. I mean, like Paul Newman eyes. I think I would have noticed if David had Paul Newman eyes. And his mouth is agape. It's just very, very poor. The hair doesn't look like anyone's hair. It certainly does not look like David's.
Yeah, David had a very distinctive haircut.
But it also doesn't look like Eddie. And he's the only person whose head it could be. And that would make sense because he sort of looked like maybe his head got chopped, but it's also not Eddie either. He doesn't have Paul Newman eyes. See, I paid attention to this movie, folks.
I just really like that you rate everybody on if they have Paul Newman eyes or not.
It's so, listen, so far we've got one person, Paul Newman. And that one lady who comes close is the lady in They Live.
Meg Foster.
Meg Foster. She's the closest I can think of.
I'm going to go back to Amy's suggestion that Jason is going through some sort of recovery. Perhaps it is some sort of occupational therapy craft that he made. He sculpted a head out of... Remember when we were kids and we would do the paper mache where you would tear up a piece of newspaper and like dip it in the goop? And then you would wrap it around a balloon, and then you would pop the balloon after everything was dry, and you'd have like this little. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking that this was a craft project to help him soothe his anxiety as he adjusts to being part of the world again.
Well, this would not be the first time that he's been known to craft, as we discovered earlier, and I think part 4, that Jason is very big into creating shrunken apple heads that he sells at the Crystal Lake Swamp Meet. This is how he expresses himself. Let me give you a couple examples of how bad this decapitated head is. It looks worse than that statue of Lucille Ball.
Oh, God. Again, with the contemporary like references, but that is a spot-on reference. People, if you have not seen that, please go out, read all the articles, and how even the sculptor had to redo it. Yeah.
It also sort of resembles that one fresco that the old lady had repainted in Italy. Makes that look like fucking Michelangelo had slipped over there on an off weekend.
Well, did you ever hear this? There's this museum. I don't know if it still exists, but it was a museum of wax figures that had not quite come out correctly.
Oh.
So this one museum, I believe, had bought them all and then, you know, staged them. But if you looked at the pictures, like, it was hilariously off. And it's supposed to be celebrities and, you know, historical figures. So when you're looking at pictures, I will have to find them and send it to you. That's kind of what it made me think of. Like a combination of what you were saying here. We've got Lucille Ball, we've got the fresco, but made in a wax museum that somebody like fell asleep in and then like a cat like pulled it out of the mold and like stretched it around a while, because it is disturbingly terrible.
It's like they made a relief of Eddie or David's face in Silly Putty and said, don't move, and just peeled it off and then put it over a styrofoam head. It is of poor quality, but we don't get to see it very long. And wouldn't you know it, Jason Voorhees has snuck in, and he's going to defenestrate Robin in very awkward style. He grabs her by the throat, and then we cut to the outside, in which we see the male stunt double of Robin throw himself out of a window. That's right. to quote the famous British spy, am I horny, baby? No, wait a second. Oh, it's a man, baby. Yeah.
I'm going to make a bold statement here. I think she could have survived that fall.
No, she kind of hits the ground at the same level that my kid did when he was learning how to do a two-wheeler. Like, she just kind of doesn't get up. It's almost like she's feigning being dead.
And also, I assume this is the same male stuntman, but you can see that they are covering their face right before they hit the ground.
Well, that's what I was trying to figure out. So I was looking at this. Now, granted, I should have paused and looked closer, but my thoughts were, was this like a Dread Pirate, like Robert's mask from The Princess Bride? So that was my first one too, because it looked like it's like kind of this like black fabric that's pulled back with like a really bad wig. Or did they make a Dread Pirate like Robert's mask from the hair? Like they took the actual wig and pulled it over his eyes. Because those are the only two things. It starts like at his eyes. Like the hair does not start up and then it's flailing. I was very distracted. Like almost to the point where I would have believed if they had been in costume. Like, you know, if they were, like, at some sort of costume party and that's what she jumped out. Like, she just happened to be in that or put that on to seem sexy and that in her pink t-shirt.
I mean, this whole sequence is so fake that the stunt team from the Bionic Woman is kind of like, oh, I'm seeing all the seams. I don't like this at all. It's just, it is of poor quality. And then when you go back to part four and you see how well that thrown out of a second story window stunt is. I mean, that is really good. And then it's a stunt woman and she hit that car twice.
Yeah.
Make that happen. It is so much better directed than this. And I'd like to apologize to our audience because this is not good. This is not a good stunt. And there's a bad stunt and people should feel bad about it. And that brings us pretty much to the end of this segment, RIPD Robin. And you know what that means. It's America's maybe 34th favorite game show, at least at this point. I mean, it's not a ripoff of Plinko or anything. It is Choose Your Own Death Venture. So what boring death will we all choose? Is it lackadaisically getting stabbed in the stomach? Is it kind of getting chopped in the neck? Maybe getting decapitated? Maybe not. Maybe that was David. Or is it having your body replaced by a dude and jumping out of a window and kind of hitting the ground while covering your face? And as our guest and our superstar here, I turn to you, Amy, for your answer first.
Well, I'm going to say, as I was watching this, I was trying to figure out what death did I want to go with. I knew straight up I'm not going with Eddie because it was just sad and pathetic all the way around.
Yes.
So initially, I was going to pick David because he's just had sex with a hot girl. Mm-hmm. He's hungry, but he's now gone down and he's found food. So really, like, he's kind of sated everything that he needed to have sated at that point, and then he gets killed. But Patrick, you just said something that kind of just changed everything for me, which is, do I want to be thrown out of a window, have my body turned into a man's body right before I fall? And so I kind of want that, because my question is, I think both it's going to be an interesting experience, even if it's really briefly, like knowing what it's like to feel like a man. Mm-hmm. Or does my consciousness go somewhere else and his body and his self is like the one that dies and I just kind of go out into the ether and wreak havoc? And that is my interpretation. Mm-hmm.
Is and that you go off into the ether, or that you turn into a man and briefly?
Well, no, that my body will turn into a man's body, but right. My like soul and whatever personality, whatever the heck it is, like I think I'm going to go off into the ether and wreak havoc.
Okay, wreak havoc. Well, yes. You've given yourself quite a proactive afterlife. Congratulations. You know what? That's called having goals, millennials.
Exactly.
That's right. We don't really rag on millennials very much here. We like you millennials just the way you are. So that brings us to you, Gina. What say you?
I will also say Robin, but for a less fascinating and elaborate reason. Mostly because I don't think anyone could possibly be killed in that manner. She looks like she fell about as far as maybe falling out of a treehouse. And maybe because mm-hmm. she covered her face before she landed on the ground, she probably broke an arm or two. But you know what? I've had a broken arm before. I can live with that again. I'm because she seemed the least fatal of the three completely unremarkable deaths in this sequence, I'm going to have to go with Robin as well.
Yeah, this makes it 3-for-3. I'm going for Robin, but of course my answer has a lot of different elements to it. One, I would be able to experience most of this movie as a woman, and then only return to my male form at the very end, when I get to jump out of a window, because I am definitely not tossed by my neck. People don't need to use their legs that much when they're tossed by their neck. That's not how being thrown out of a window works. You don't have a lot of lower body force involved. The other part is that, of course, you know, I'd be spending the entire movie as a hot chick with killer bangs, and I get to smoke a lot of doobs.
Yeah, but you missed out on the one that looks like about the size and width of a magic marker.
That's true. That's absolutely true. But, you know, listen, we all leave somewhat unsatisfied to some degree, with the exception of Amy, who comes back as a vengeful ghost, some sort of grudge entity.
Let me tell you, I am an Olympic gold medalist if there was like a grudge competition. So I proudly take that on.
Right. Take that as a warning, Kill by Kill listeners. Do not cross Amy. All right. That pretty much wraps it up. Hey, Amy, where can people find out more about you and what you're doing?
Probably the easiest way is to find us over at ladieslovepaulrudd.com. We are feminine and feminist gazing the hell out of Paul Rudd, movie by movie and TV show by TV show, which has been fantastic with my co-host Larissa. If you want, you can also track me down on Twitter over there at Amy Pop, AmyPop.
Excellent. All right. Hey, Gina, where can people find you on the internet?
I know, considering you know how very rarely I resort to referencing things more than 30 years ago, I write about 70s and 80s television at tuneintonight.wordpress.com.
All right, do it today, people. Don't wait. Hey, do you want to talk to us? There's a couple different ways you can do it. A, you can reach out to us on Twitter. It's how most people do it, at Kill by Kill Pod. We tweets all the time when we're not working, and we're working a lot lately, so I apologize. And I went on vacation. What are you going to do? But please, if you got 140 characters worth of things to say to us, reach out. Got something more than that? Why not send us an email? You'd probably be the first person to do it. Kill by Kill Pod at gmail.com. We're also on Instagram at Kill by Kill Podcast. And if you rate and review us on iTunes and you tell us what your favorite death is in the Friday the 13th franchise, we will tell everyone about it on the air here. That is our solemn promise to you, Kill by Kill listener. Don't fret, people. Just because we're done today, the body count continues. We got a lot of fun things happening in the near future. Halloween is just a few weeks away, so there's all sorts of cool stuff a-popping here at the Kill by Kill podcast. But until then, the body count continues. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
Kill by Kill is produced by We Write Good and is intended for entertainment purposes only. Friday the 13th is owned by Paramount Pictures. Jason is owned by New Line Cinema. No infringement is intended. Kill by Kill logo was designed by Josh Hollis. Visit him at joshhollis.com. The Kill by Kill theme was created exclusively for us by Revenge Body. Get the whole track and much, much more at revengebodymemphis.bandcamp.com today.